Mr. Salva has already said, we're back from the feast, and we're back into the world, and of course, we know the worldly holidays are approaching, and these holidays have long origins that go back literally thousands of years, Halloween, Christmas, very long origins, and the practice of them is very, very deeply rooted in our character as a nation. And this week, my wife has been taking her morning walks and taking some photos of the Halloween decorations around our neighborhood, and really they're quite gruesome, some of them, a little definitely over the top. There was one with a picturing a bus stop, somebody, I think it's a skeleton, sitting on a bench at a bus stop, and in front of him on the ground is arising this half torso of a man, all bloody. And he's holding a bloody sword, and there's a bloody limb laying on the ground in front of the bus stop. And it's just way over the top, and of course we know it's all a celebration in supposedly in good taste and good fun. Well, I wouldn't even say good taste, but supposedly in good fun. But it's really indicative of something that is a part of our national character, that we approach God and worship God in ways that we see fit, worshiping God in a way that looks right in our own eyes, thinking this is fine. Well, this was also the problem with Israel from the very beginning of their time in the land. Even before they came into the land, they were struggling with the sin of idolatry in the wilderness. They showed a proclivity toward that. And we remember, of course, the golden calf. They worshiped the golden calf just not long after they had been delivered by God from Egypt. And they were really simply only following the customs of the world around them, even the dictates of their own heart, and thinking this was okay to bless God or to worship God in this way. Well, there is a lesson for us in the idolatry of Israel and their example that we must keep ourselves unspotted from this world. It's also a lesson for us that we cannot worship God in the manner that we see fit, but in the way that God commands. And that we cannot simply think that God is blessing us because we think it's right, but we must not follow him according to the dictates of our heart, but according to the way he says. Well, before they entered the promised land of Canaan, God knew what was in the heart of Israel. He already knew that they had this proclivity to stray from him. And today we're going to look at one particular tribe among the children of Israel, the tribe of Dan. And Dan's idolatry reared its head early in the time that Israel had come into the land. They began to practice idolatry quite openly, as we'll see in the story that we'll look at today. And it had implications for the entire course of the nation. And perhaps you've read the story about Dan's idolatry in the book of Judges. And maybe you wonder, why is this story here? It might seem like a strange and obscure story when we look at it. And we'll read through it today, go through it as we learn about it. But that story, brethren, has implications for us today. It has lessons for us that we can draw from it. One of the effects that we could see from Dan's idolatry, the tribe of Dan and their idolatry, is how long the effects of that practice, that idolatrous practice, carry over into the future generations. Of making God in their own image, then it becomes deeply ingrained in the culture, even as we see in our world today, in our culture today. So we know the story of Israel's the deliverance from Egypt. They're coming through the wilderness and coming into the promised land. Of course, we know Joshua led them into the promised land, and it was toward the end of his life that Joshua gathered the Israelites together. Because the land had not yet fully been conquered. And he brought them together toward the end of his life, and he said to them what they must do before he departed, they must fear God and obey him. And so this is where we'll start the story in Joshua chapter 24. Let's come to Joshua chapter 24. It's at the end of Joshua's life. And he brings all of them in. At the end of the book of Joshua chapter 24, starting in verse 13, this is Joshua speaking for God himself. God, through Joshua, says, I have given you a land for which you do not labor, the cities which you do not build, this is verse 13, and you dwell in them, and you eat of the vineyards and the olive groves which you did not plant. And now Joshua speaks to them. This is Joshua speaking now in verse 14. Now therefore, fear the Lord. Fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. Now, this was generations before, but this proclivity toward idolatry was still in and among the people at that time. And Joshua tells them, put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the river, that's the river Euphrates, and in Egypt. And the people, of course, they swore their obedience. They were going to obey the Lord. They were going to fear the Lord. That's what they said. And I think Joshua rightly doubted their intentions. Here's what the people said, verse 24, skipping down to verse 24. And the people said to Joshua, the Lord our God, we will serve, and his voice we will obey. And so this was a momentous moment, a moment to be remembered. So Joshua set up a stone as a witness to their words, as we read in the final verses of Joshua chapter 24. He set up a stone as a witness to their words that they will serve the Lord. And verse 31, as we come down toward the end of the chapter, verse 31, and Israel did serve the Lord, it says. Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. But as we're going to see today in the story of Dan's idolatry, the trouble had already begun. Israel had started to already go after other gods and already begun to worship God in their own image. So the story of, or the title rather, of today's message is The Idolatry of Dan. And we're going to apply the lessons of Dan's idolatry to ourselves. We know the commandment against idolatry. This is Exodus 20, where the commandments are listed, the Ten Commandments, where God says, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not make yourself a carved image. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord, as the command continues, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. The effects of idolatry extend down through generations. And we'll see that today in the story of the idolatry of Dan. Once the children of Israel had entered the land, the trouble began. It began rather quickly. Many of that generation that had come in with Joshua did remain faithful, but the cracks had started to show. When we come to the book of Judges, as we will here to read this story, one of the themes, the main theme of that story, of the whole book of Judges, is that at that time, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. They went and worshiped God, even according to what they thought was right. So to begin Dan's story, we'll stay in Joshua for a little bit and come with me to Joshua chapter 18. And this is where Joshua is dividing the land, dividing the inheritance among the tribes of the children of Israel. At this time, we'll see in chapter 18 of Joshua, the land had not been fully conquered. There was still land yet to be subdued and brought under the control of the Israelites. So here we are, we see in verse 1 of Joshua 18. Now the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting there. And the land was subdued before them. Well, the land around that area was certainly subdued. However, verse 2 says, there remained among the children of Israel 7 tribes which had not yet received their inheritance. And one of these 7 tribes was Dan. Not all the land had been conquered. The inhabitants of the land were not going to leave without a fight. And God told them that he would be with them. If they go into the land and conquer the land, he would be with them. And that's what they were to do. Into the lot that had fallen to them, they were to go in and conquer that land. And they were to believe God and look to him and take that land. So 7 tribes had not yet received their inheritance. So this is what Joshua told them to do. In verse 6 of Joshua 18, verse 6, you shall therefore survey the land in 7 parts for each of the 7 tribes, and bring the survey here to me that I may cast lots for you here before the Lord our God. Bring the survey back, and right here in Shiloh, I will cast the lots. So God was in this process of casting the lots for the inheritance of the tribes. And then verse 8, the men rose to go away, and Joshua charged those who went to survey the land, saying, go walk through the land and survey it, and come back to me that I may cast lots for you here before the Lord in Shiloh. And this was to reveal God's will. And so the men went, verse 9, passed through the land and wrote in the survey, in a book, 7 parts, a 7-part survey by the cities, and they came to Joshua at the camp in Shiloh. And they brought that with them, showing the 7 parts, and it was divided by the cities in each of those parts. And Joshua there, verse 10, cast lots for them in Shiloh before the Lord. And there Joshua divided the land to the children of Israel according to their division, these 7 remaining tribes. Well, let's come down all the way to verse 40. Verse 40. And the 7th lot, verse 40 of Joshua, I'm sorry, I think we're in next chapter, chapter 19. So I skipped. We're over into the next chapter, chapter 19. And the 7th lot came out for the children of Dan according to their families. They were the last of those 7. And this was the Lord's doing, the casting of the lots, showing what his will was to be. In the scriptures then, in the verses that follow in chapter 19 and verse 41 through 48 or so, describe the inheritance of the children of Dan. But notice, let's take a look at our map here. So if you have your map with you, take a quick look at that. And we'll look to see where the inheritance by lot of the children of Dan was. So if you could find it on that map, there's a little text box next to it. And you'll see there, pointing to that area which the green lines through it, that's where Dan's lot was cast. The land assigned to the tribe of Dan by Joshua. That's right there. That piece. Okay. Now we're going to notice something else. Dan went beyond what the lot had been cast for them. Notice verse 47. And the border of the children of Dan went beyond these, because the children of Dan went up to fight against Lashem and took it, verse 47 here. And they struck it with the edge of the sword, and took possession of it and dwelt in it. And they called Lashem Dan, after the name of Dan, their father. This is the inheritance of the tribe of Dan, verse 48, according to their families. So where is Leshem? Now we go up here to the other text box you'll see at the top here. This is over 100 miles away, far outside of the area that had been assigned to Dan by lot. This is the territory up here. This is the city where Dan took, as it says. They took it, verse 47 says, and struck it with the edge of the sword and dwelt in it. So Dan had received their inheritance from the Lord in the land, but they went beyond it. They took matters into their own hands. This is the problem with Israel all through the time of the judges, because the people were doing what was right in their own eyes. This is the theme resonating through that book, that everyone did what was right in his own eyes, thinking that the Lord was blessing them. Now we'll come to Judges chapter 18, and we'll see the detail of what verse 47 of Joshua 19 just described for us, where Dan went beyond and took this area way up in the north. Judges chapter 18 is the beginning of the detail here of what Dan had done. Verse 1 of Judges 18 now. And we'll go through this story. And again, you've probably read through this story before and wondered, what does it all mean? What does it all mean? In those days, verse 1, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the Danites were seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes had not fallen to them. Remember that they were to go in and take the land. But as we'll read, and we could read it elsewhere in the scripture, we won't turn there. There was not exactly the easiest thing to do, to go in and take the land from those who were there. They were not going to go without a fight. So the Danites decided, let's go find some land that we like. They took matters into their own hands, thinking they did well. Not content to dwell with where God had put them by lot, and found instead a place that they wanted for themselves. I'll take a pause for a moment here in this sermon to explain that the book of Judges is not entirely chronological. Because through the judges, as we go from one judge to another, to another, to another, that's typically chronological in order of what has happened. But this section of the book of Judges obviously has taken place, or obviously took place, near the beginning of Israel's time in the land. It took place near the beginning. And the judges goes for several hundred years. But this took place near the beginning of that time. So not an entirely chronological book, as a side note for you and your future studies. And so verse 2 now. Let's continue the story of Dan going to take their land outside of the lot that had been cast. So the children of Dan, verse 2, sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtaol, to spy out the land and search it. And they said to them, they said to these 5, go and search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. So now we have to back up a little bit. We have to take a step back and find out from the scripture, who is Micah? Well, Micah is in Ephraim. And if we see where Ephraim was, they had traveled from their allotted territory, Dan had, not all that far, up into the mountains of Ephraim, just to the north of their allotted territory. And there they go in and lodge in this house of Micah. Let's back up one chapter here to chapter 17, and let's read the story of Micah. Because here, brethren, the plot thickens. The plot thickens. Verse 1 of chapter 17. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here's the silver with me. I took it. Let's just think about what just happened here. This man stole 1,100 shekels of silver from his mother. His mother cursed whoever had taken it. He had even heard the curse. And so he finally came and felt remorse and said, okay, it was me. Here's your 1,100 shekels back. That's what happens here. And this tells you something about the character of Micah, but notice the character of the mother as well, as we'll see. She says, the mother said, verse 2, may you be blessed by the Lord, my son. There was no rebuking him. It was just, oh, my son, thank you so much for returning this 1,100 shekels. This man, Micah, as we'll see in this story, figures very prominently. Here we see his character, and we also see the character of his mother, who just overlooks his flaws, and somehow she obtained this wealth. Scripture doesn't say how she obtained this wealth, but perhaps it had been plunder taken during Israel's conquest of the land to that point. Perhaps it had come from the plunder that had been taken by the children of Israel out of Egypt. This was just one generation later. We don't know, but it was a sizable sum, 1,100 shekels of silver. And so let's continue the story. Verse 3, when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for you, my son, for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. And now, therefore, I will return it to you. What did she say? She said, I was going to use that to make a carved image and a molded image for you, my son. Her thought was already to do something idolatrous with this money. And thus, in this manner, verse 4, he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took the 200 shekels of that silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were there in the house of Micah. Well, if we back up a moment, brethren, there is something really wrong with this picture. We have the character of Micah, the character of his mother, and we have his mother saying, well, I'm going to make a carved image, a molded image, and giving that image to her son, who brings it into his house. Everything going outside of the commandment, not to make any gods before the true God, not to make graven images, but this is worshiping God in their own way and thinking it is okay. And so the man Micah, verse 5, had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. He made one of his sons his own priest. And verse 6 then, of Judges chapter 17, this is really the theme of the book of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And what we've just witnessed in the scriptures here is that Micah is perpetuating idolatry that his mother had already sanctioned. And the commandment against idolatry tells us that this kind of action will be perpetuated, the consequences will be perpetuated through future generations. God is showing us here in the scriptures the beginning of something that took place in Israel that would have implications for the entire nation, for the history of the entire nation. And it began with a mother and her son. But as we'll see through this story, it became something much, much greater. And now, the plot continues. Verse 7. And now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, one of the family of Judah, and he was a Levite. And he was staying there in Judah, in Bethlehem. And that man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. And then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. So we have another twist in the plot. This Levite from Bethlehem goes to the house of Micah. It's curious why he was wandering in the first place. It does fit into the theme of the book of Judges that everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. And so he comes to Micah's house. Now, Micah's house was apparently on some kind of a major roadway. So he comes to Micah's home. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from? Where do you come from?" So he said to him, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm on my way to find a place to stay." And Micah said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year and a suit of clothes and your sustenance." So the Levite went in, 10 shekels a year. Now, his mother had 1,100 shekels, and apparently 10 shekels was a year's wages. So you can see the value of 1,100 shekels of silver. And so the Levite took him up on that offer, and he went in. Now, God had commanded the Levites to be priests for the people. They were not going to have an inheritance in the land, and he commanded the people to support the Levites. And so it seemed right in Micah's eyes to support this priest. And it seems that the priest thinking, "Well, I don't have an inheritance in the land, so I'm just going to go and find the place where it suits me." This seems to be what's going on here. And it seemed like both men were obeying God, thinking they were obeying God, but putting their own ideas first. So, verse 11, as the story continues, the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons. And so Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest. It's my own personal priest right here in my house. And I've got my idols here too, my graven images. And then Micah says this, verse 13, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me." God's going to bless me now, because I have a Levite as a priest. He's basically making God into his own image. So we see this idolatry is beginning to compound. He appropriates God's blessing because he thinks he's doing well. And this is the curious story of Micah. This is whom the Danites then encounter, as we have already read in chapter 18. The Danites come to the same place. So let's go back to chapter 18 where we were. We left off in verse 2. The Danites came to the house of Micah, verse 2 of chapter 18, and they lodged there. Now verse 3. And while they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. And they turned him aside and said to him, "Well, who brought you here?" Apparently they recognized his accent as being someone from another location, or perhaps they actually knew who he was, had seen him before. We don't really know at this point, but they asked him then, "Who brought you here?" Verse 3, "What are you doing here? What do you have here? What do you have here?" And he said to them, verse 4, the Levite said, "Well, thus and so Micah did for me. He has hired me, and I've become his priest. I'm Micah's priest. And that's why I'm here in this house." In a matter-of-fact way, the Levite tells the Danites what his business is. What he's doing, though, is all wrong. And so do the Danites say, "Well, you know, God's commandment says that you should not have any gods before him"? No. Well, what did they do? They asked for a blessing themselves. They think, "Oh, well, this must be right. He's a priest." And so, verse 5, they said, "Please inquire of God that we might know whether the journey on which we go will be prosperous." And the priest said to them, "Go in peace." And so the presence and the presence of the Lord be with you on your way. And so we know where they went. They went from the mountains of Ephraim and traveled to the north. The five men departed and went to Laish in the north, as we see on the map, far north. And there, verse 7 now, they saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians. They were quiet and secure. And there were no rulers in the land that who might put them to shame for anything. So there was nobody kind of watching out for them, defending them. The land was open. And they were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone. So the spies came back. They'd seen this good land here. They came back, and they come back, to, verse 8, to their brethren at Zorah and Eshtol. And their brethren said to them, what's your report? So the Danites come back, the five men, and their fellow Danites said, what'd you find? What was up there? They had found what they were looking for. This is a choice piece of real estate, and it's easy to get. Remember what God told Israel to do? Go in and conquer the land, and I will be with you. The Danites said, no, this one looks a lot better over here. They went beyond their lot. This place where they had found is very well watered by the streams that come from Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is the tallest mountain or the tallest peak in that area. And off of Mount Hermon come the streams that feed the Jordan River. You've been on the United Church of God tours of Israel. We go to this place. It's very beautiful. It's up on a higher area, very well watered and lush, lots of greenery. And it's a choice piece of land. And so the five said, verse 9, then, arise and let us go against them. For we have seen the land, and it indeed is very good. Would you do nothing? Would you just stay here and do nothing? Don't hesitate to go to enter and possess the land. And when you go, you will come to a secure people and a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is in the earth. And they were making again God in their own image, saying, God blessed us with this. We have to look at ourselves, brethren, and we see things in our lives and think, boy, you know, I know God wants me to be happy. And I know he wants me to enjoy things. I think I'm going to enjoy this. But we go outside the bounds of his law for our own pleasure. That's a lesson we could draw from this, that we don't do that. The Danites here are taking matters in their own hands. They're believing that God blessed them. They say, God has given it into your hands. It's a lesson for us. And so, as we see in verse 11, 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there. 600 armed men, armed with weapons of war, as we see in verse 11. And then in verse 13, and they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Again, Micah, this house seems to have been on the thoroughfare going north. And here they were now, 600 armed men, ready to go north and take take Laish for themselves, outside of their allotment. And then the five men, verse 14, continuing, who had gone up to spy out the country of Laish, answered and said to their brethren, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household items, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore consider what you should do. So the five original spies were with the 600 armed men. And they are at the house of Micah again. They said, you know what's here? You know what's here? An ephod, household items, a carved image, and a molded image. Now think about it. What are you going to do? What do? They decide, we're going to take that. We're going to make that priest our priest. Because we want God's blessing. This is the attitude that they had. They are going to go get their land now, outside of what God allotted them. And they're going to take what they think are God's blessings with them, having a priest, their own priest, and their idols. This is what's happening. So now we see this sin of idolatry is perpetuating. And so they turned aside there, verse 15, and came to the house of the young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. So they said, you have 600 armed men, weapons of war, who were the children of Dan, stood by the gate. Verse 16 says, this all there, ready for war. Now what would you do if 600 armed soldiers came to your front door? You'd probably do whatever they asked. Try to keep peace. And then, verse 17, then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. So those five, they knew what was in the house. So they went up and entered there, verse 17 says, and they took the carved image. They took the ephod, the household items, and the molded image. And the priest, this Levite priest, stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. Once again, they're taking matters into their own hands. And when these five had went into Micah's house, verse 18 now, and took the carved image, took the ephod, the household items, and the molded image, the priest said, what are you doing? What are you doing? And they said to him, verse 19, be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? Obviously, brethren, they're doing it their way, not God's way. And they offer this Levite a better job opportunity, better pay. More responsibility. The Danites are going to get their inheritance in the land, which they think is theirs, that they've appropriated for themselves. And they're also going to take and get their own priests and their own objects of worship. And it seemed right in their own eyes. But it was completely idolatrous. It was completely against the commandments of God. So when the priest heard their job offer, verse 20, his heart was glad. And so he took him up, took the offer, he took the ephod, took the household items and the carved image, and he took his place among the people, and he went up gladly. So much for Micah and his house. Look at what I'm going to have now. And then they turned and departed, and they put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them, presumably because they felt they wanted to protect their rear as they were leaving. So they put the little ones in front, and the armed men were at the rear. And the Levite himself, whose name we still don't know, was with them. And of course, Micah was not just going to stand around and let people take his priests and his idols. So Micah gathered his men, took off in pursuit, and came near. Verse 23, they came near, and they called out to the children of Dan, Micah and his men. And so they turned around, the men of Dan turned around and said to Micah, what ails you? Why have you gathered such a company? And you might say, in other words, what's your problem that you came out here with all these guys? Why are you doing this? What's your problem? And so he said, verse 24, Micah answered, you have taken away my gods, which I made, and the priests, and you have gone away. Now what more do I have? How can you say to me, what ails you? How can you say that? Now what we see here going on, brethren, this is base, carnal, human behavior. This is not godly behavior at all between the Micah and his men and the Danites. The children of Dan then said to him, Verse 25, do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household. Now you could rephrase that and say, shut your mouth unless you want to die. This is basically what they said to him. Shut your mouth unless you want to die. This is brutal, base, carnal behavior over these idols and over this priest. You can see, brethren, there's nothing good that's happening here in this story. And so, verse 26, the children of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and he went back to his house. He realized, that's it. I am not going to survive if I go against them, so they're too strong. I give up. So he turned around, and that's the last we hear of Micah. He exits the story now, and it's a rather sad and pitiful exit. He leaves the story. At this point, he has made his idols from the family wealth. That's been taken from him. He's hired this priest. That's been taken from him. And it was all wrong. And so he just turns around dejectedly and goes home. And that's all we hear of him. He loses it all to this group of carnal people who are out to get for themselves. And I think if we look at the lesson of Micah himself, how futile it is to trust in gods of our own making. So this is what Micah did. He trusted in gods of his own making. And it was totally futile. Didn't do any good for him. And so verse 27, the Danites, verse 27, they took the things Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him, and they went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. It's a very sad end to the people of Laish. And there's nothing in the scriptures that God had wanted them to go and attack this area and take these people. The Danites did this on their own. God had given them an allotment that he said he wanted them to go take. But it was hard. There were people who resisted, but this was easy. We can get this, and it is good land. This is what they did. So they took that area outside of the allotment that God had ordained and revealed by lot. Very sad. There was no deliverer, verse 28, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. They didn't have any allies, no one to depend upon to help them, to help deliver them. And it was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. And so they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. They came in, killed all the people, destroyed the city, and rebuilt it. They got what they wanted, the Danites. And they called the name of that city, verse 29, Dan. And that's what we see here on our map. The name of that city was Dan after the name of their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name formally explains again here was Laish in verse 29. And so what did they do? Set up their idolatrous practices, which they thought was the right thing to do. For in those days, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so, verse 30, the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image and Jonathan, the son of Gershom. Now we finally hear his name. Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. Now, there's something very interesting in this verse here. That name, Manasseh, is rendered in many commentaries, and it might be in the margin of your scripture, it is in mine, as Moses. Moses. Moses did have a son named Gershom. Even in our United Church of God commentary, you could read how we say that it is a possibility. This was another name for Moses. The writer put it in as Manasseh, but with the Hebrew vowels and the pointing of the vowel points, they rendered it as Manasseh, but it really meant Moses. If it was the Moses, Manasseh is Moses in verse 30, that means Jonathan is the grandson of Moses. And that adds a great deal of intrigue to this story. Now, we cannot say that for sure, but again, many of the commentaries think that this is the case, including we speculate that in our own commentary that it is, but we don't know for certain. But if it was, then you can see why, well, just imagine, we've got Moses' son, grandson, as our priest. We're going to go up. What could go wrong? Perhaps that is the case. At some point, I'm sure we will know. But notice here, also in verse 30, notice how long this idolatrous practice continued. In the very last phrase of verse 30, until the day of the captivity of the land. So this idolatry was perpetuated for generations. We know that Israel fell in 722 BC. The land was conquered and taken somewhere perhaps around 1200 to 1250 BC. So there was a span of perhaps 500 years of idolatrous practice at this place. At this place where Dan had set up their carved images. Remember how it started. The mother and her son. And it started from a small sin, but it perpetuated. It went on. Sin was begetting sin. And so they set up, verse 31, Micah's carved image, which he had made, and all the house, all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh, and even beyond the time that the house was in Shiloh, even to the captivity of the land. So all during the time of David, all during the time of Solomon, all during the time of the kings of northern Israel, this was a place of idolatrous worship. And if we know the history of Israel, we know that this did not escape the eyes of Jeroboam. Now, who was Jeroboam? We know that Israel divided into north and south. Solomon's son, Rehoboam, had an adversary, though, in Jeroboam. And Jeroboam threatened to take the northern 10 tribes with him if Rehoboam would not acquiesce to their demands, because Solomon had been too tough on them, Solomon, Rehoboam's father. But we know the story there. Rehoboam did not listen, and Jeroboam took the northern 10 tribes with him. And he looked around, and he used the city of Dan to political advantage to keep his gain of the northern 10 tribes. We know that story, I think. It's in 1 Kings. We'll take a look at it. Seeking verse Kings chapter 12, if you would turn with me there now. Seeking a way to keep the northern 10 tribes on his side, Jeroboam made Dan as a center of worship. It already was. It was a center of idolatrous worship. And Jeroboam said in his heart, verse 26 of 1 Kings 12. 1 Kings 12, verse 26. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they'll kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So what did he do? He took counsel, verse 28, 1 Kings 12. Therefore the king asked advice, and he made 2 calves of gold and said to the people, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which you brought up from the land of Egypt. And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. It was quite logical, because it was already a place of idolatry. And this thing, verse 30, became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. So apparently, of the two, Bethel and Dan, Dan had more preeminence. Apparently, that's what it says in verse 30. The people went to worship before the one as far as Dan, and it became a sin. It became a national sin, and it led to the captivity of the northern 10 tribes. And so verse 31, the last verse we'll read here in 1 Kings, he made shrines on the high places, and he made priests from every class of people who were not the sons of Levi, really for political gain. But the people accepted it because they thought, well, we're still worshiping God. But they weren't. They were worshiping God in their own image, which we know is not true worship. So Dan's idolatry is a very intriguing story in the scripture. And what seems like a rather peculiar and strange story in the book of Judges has far-reaching implications through the course of Israel's history. This area actually continued even after the captivity of Israel as a center of pagan worship. In the New Testament times, in the Greek and Roman times, there was a temple built here to the god Pan, built just a few miles away in the Roman city of Caesarea Philippi. So without going into too much detail, the Greco-Roman god Pan had a temple just a few miles from this area in the city of Caesarea Philippi. The Romans built an additional temple there to Caesar. Two pagan temples within a few miles of the city of Dan. And it was here that Christ brought his disciples. Matthew chapter 16, Christ brings his disciples to Caesarea Philippi. Now, I mentioned that we had been to this place. I think I did mention it on our tours of Israel. We had been to Dan, and we took a very short bus ride then over to Caesarea Philippi and saw the place around which this scene in Matthew 16 took place. Matthew 16. Now, Caesarea Philippi was built on a large rock outcropping, very large. And Christ brings his disciples here and says to them, verse 13, who do men say that I am? And some of them say, well, John the Baptist, Elijah, and others said, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And he said, well, who do you say that I am? In verse 15. And Peter answered correctly in verse 16, saying, you are Christ, the Son of the living God. Christ's answer is this: blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I say to you, verse 18 now, I say to you that on this rock, meaning himself, I will build my church. But remember, they're at this place of pagan worship that is built on a rock just a short distance from the ancient pagan worship center of Dan. And there's pagan temples here now. On this rock I will build my church, meaning him on this rock himself, and the gates of hell, or Hades, will not prevail against it. Very interesting, because Caesarea Philippi was built on a rock, and it had pagan temples. and the gates of hell will not prevail against the church of God. Very interesting indeed. Another interesting thing about Dan, perhaps you know this, that among the 144,000 who are mentioned in Revelation chapter 7, all the tribes of the children of Israel are mentioned there, but not Dan. The tribes of the children of Israel are mentioned there, but not Dan. I think there is actually another one that is also not mentioned, but Dan is not mentioned. Could it be because of his idolatry? We don't know. I'm sure the children of Dan will be in the kingdom of God, but perhaps they will not be in the first resurrection. Perhaps not. We don't know, but it is interesting that the name of Dan is not mentioned, perhaps because of his idolatry, among the tribes of the children of Israel, sealed in Revelation chapter 7. The idolatry of Dan has long implications in the scriptures, and what appears to be an odd and perhaps peculiar story in the book of Judges actually carries tremendous weight, because the sin that we see perpetuated here, the sin of idolatry, has ramifications that extend throughout the generations of the children of Israel. That system of idolatry that became ingrained in the culture of Israel, of the northern 10 tribes, taken away into captivity. That idolatry led to their downfall. And as we understand history, we know that God has sifted the seed of the children of Israel through the nations. And we come to our present day, and we look at our nation, our world, and see that we are a people who are given to idolatry. We make God in our own image as a nation and worship God in ways of our own choosing as a people, as these holidays coming up certainly show us. Remember the commandment that reads, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, and you shall not bow down to them or serve them. And remember that the ill effects of idolatry extend down through generations. For God says that he visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. That's from the commandment in Exodus chapter 20. I hope you've gotten a sense now about the implications of that story. Perhaps it seemed strange and obscure to you before, of the idolatry of the children of Dan and how it perpetuated and became a national sin that even has ramifications down to our present day. The lesson for us, brethren, is, of course, that we must keep ourselves out of this world, must not make the customs of the world our own, the way they observe or worship God. They must not become our customs. And we must not take matters into our own hands, thinking God is blessing us when he's not, because that's what our carnal mind is telling us. This was the problem with the children of Dan. They thought they were doing right in their own eyes and that God was blessing them. There's lessons for us today. Well, let's take these lessons from the scriptural record of the idolatry of Dan.